Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Nancy Townsley, author of the new novel Sunshine Girl from Heliotrope Books. Nancy's work has appeared in Newsweek, Hippocampus, The Big Smoke, Nailed Magazine, The Timberline Review, Elephant Journal, and several anthologies. Sunshine Girl is her debut novel, inspired by her 38 years as a newspaper reporter and editor. Nancy lives here in Portland in a floating home along the Multnomah Channel. In the words of writer Susie Vitello, Sunshine Girl is a rare, up-close view of mass media, the financial collapse of print journalism, and the post-truth era of clickbait news, and Laura Stanfill calls the book a powerful piece of fiction that honors the art of truth-telling. Please join us for our conversation with Nancy Townsley, which is already in progress. Well, Nancy, welcome to KABU, where I spent my brief career in journalism, co-anchoring a few evening newscasts. Of course, your career in journalism lasted a lot longer, 38 years, from the age of 21 to your retirement at the age of 59. Now, you majored in journalism at Oregon State University, and the reason you chose this field of study are certainly one of the main reasons goes back to your senior year in high school.
It does, Ken.
And a teacher plays a big part, huh?
Yeah, a very special teacher. And she's no longer with us, but Mrs. Letty Owings, just a superb human being and a wonderful teacher, the kind of teacher who has high expectations because she knows what her students are capable of, but also was very compassionate. Letty Owings, when she left Lake Ridge High School, went on to become the executive at Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, and she also started the Letty Owings House for pregnant women who had addiction, and it was a recovery program. So she was wonderful. And what she did for me particularly was she wrote in the margin of one of my report cards, back when we had, you know, paper report cards, that I had a flair for writing, and I really took that to heart. This was 1974 or 75.
And nobody had told you that before.
Huh? Well, you know, I mean, a few people might have alluded to, hey, I like what you write, but Mrs. Owings meant more than that. She meant you could probably make a career out of this.
Wow.
And so that was impressive to me. I was very much an admirer of hers. And so I decided, okay, what could I do as a writer? Well, I could become a journalist. And so that's what led me to studying journalism in college.
Now, right after graduation, you got your first job as a professional journalist at the Newburgh Graphic.
It's true, I did.
And you described that as a ma and pa owned rural weekly paper.
Yes.
I guess there aren't too many of those left, unfortunately.
Right.
And Nancy, you were hired as their sports editor, though you didn't have much experience writing about or even playing sports. You were a cheerleader in high school, and you went to a few Beaver games, football games at Oregon State. But the news editor at the Graphic, again, you got this, like Letty Owings, his name, J. Michael Fagan, he saw potential, and he convinced the publisher to hire you. Take a shot.
Yes, he did. I still remember the meeting. I think I met with Michael first, which was helpful because he was not my contemporary. He was older than me, but the publisher was another generation above. And so Michael kind of vetted me, I would say, and then he went to bat for me with the publisher there. It was a, you know, a husband and wife team who owned this little paper. It was published every Thursday, I believe it was. This was 1980. And yeah, they wanted to offer me the sports editor position. And I think I sort of did the fake it till you make it deal.
Covering like games at Newburgh High School.
I mean, I knew something about football because I had been a cheerleader and I had run track. And so I knew something about the spring sports. And I figured that I could learn the rest. And that's what I did for the first couple of years.
Now, he not only helped you get hired, but he was a big influence on your work as a journalist. What did you learn from Michael? He was one of kind of those old-fashioned journalists, committed to the truth and reporting the facts?
Very much so. Very much so. I really learned, I don't know how to even, you know, couch what I learned from Michael, other than pretty much everything. This was back in the days when we took all of our own photos, obviously not digital. We developed film in the dark room.
Wrote on typewriters?
Yes, we wrote on ancient invention. IBM Selectrics. And then it didn't take long for us to go computerized. But in the very beginning, I would hear Michael, you know, tapping away on his IBM Selectric, and he was always so devoted to the news. Just, he wanted to find out what was going on in our little community there in Newburgh. I don't remember how many people lived there at the time, less than 20,000 for sure. And, you know, Michael just showed me the ropes. He taught me how to cultivate sources and how to gain trust with sources and how to ride that line between being objective, but also finding about the person behind the story. You need to have your sources trust that you're going to be honest with them. If you need to report something that you suspect they might not like, it's important to talk to them about that ahead of time.
Get their permission.
Yeah, permission, or at least give them a heads up so that they're not surprised by reading it at the breakfast table the next morning. Michael was a very adventurous journalist. He liked the quirky. He liked, you know, one time we covered a story, and there's a fictionalized version in my novel. We went out to an old watering hole in Dundee, and we were told that there might be an undercover gambling operation out there. And
so that's right, I remember that.
So we spent time out there, and nothing came of it. But, you know, it was the type of thing that Michael would really get excited about doing. And, he unfortunately passed away when he was only, I think, 36 years old.
From cancer,
and left a wife and a daughter. I'm still in touch with his former spouse. But he did a lot of living in those 36 years. I can still see him walking down the street with his jaunty pace, and he wore a fedora, kind of like the old style newsman, and he, you know, he smoked cigars, and he loved life. And I learned that being a serious journalist didn't mean that you had to be boring and staid. You could be someone who really relished life and relished learning about people and doing something different every day.
Boy, a lot of those old-time journalists were like that, huh? I'm thinking of some of the New Yorkers like Jimmy Breslin and Studs Terkel in Chicago.
Oh, yeah. I remember reading Studs Terkel in high school, you know, working. You know, that was
Those great oral interview books.
Yeah, uh-huh. For sure.
Oral history.
Yeah. I loved my time in Newburgh. It lasted 4 years. And at the time, I thought, that seemed like forever. Why wasn't I moving up in the world? But now that I look back on those early years, I can see why it was such a formative time. And I was ready then to move on to a bigger, always weeklies for me, community journalist all the way. But the Lake Oswego Review was the next step.
When you started, you were only 21 at the time.
True.
And a little green, no doubt. You know, but
a lot green.
Thanks to Michael, you ramped up fairly quickly. Yeah. But what kept you going, working as a journalist for the next 38 years?
Wow. I think it was, I just mentioned that every day was something different. It was never boring. You could arrive at work, you know, at 8 a.m. thinking, okay, I've got an interview at 9, I've got one at 11, I have to attend city council in the evening. But then something would happen. You know, there'd be a house fire and you'd have to go cover that. Or
an illegal gambling operation.
right. Or a crazy, you know, hippie concert out in the woods.
Right, which is also in the book.
You'd be drug out there or to the cat shelter. A lot of things. So it was a little bit like the Forrest Gump life. You never, you know, like a box of chocolates. You never knew what you were going to get.
Every day was different.
And I really felt so rewarded by people letting me into their lives. They, you know, they would talk to me about what made them tick. You know, they would talk to me about how they got into the line of work that they had done themselves. They would talk to me about what it was like to lose a child. They would talk to me about, you know, how tough it was being on a school board, and it was a volunteer position, and they really were wanting to do something important for their community, But there was also the politics of it, and maybe they found themselves on the wrong side of public sentiment. All of those things that make up a life. And I felt like it was very, very important work.
Now, over those 38 years, you were a reporter and editor for several other community papers. So you mentioned the next step was the Lake Oswego Review, Beaverton Valley Times, Forest Grove News Times, and you did some work for the Portland Business Journal. And you retired in 2017 while at the Forest Grove News Times. Why did you leave journalism?
Correct.
At that time, that's 38 years.
Right.
You were still relatively young,
yeah,
relative to me.
I wasn't quite 60 at the time. So the way that I think of it now is that at that point, it just felt like the tide was shifting quite a lot in our nation, not just politically. And I use that word politics kind of loosely because, As my dear dad used to say, everything is political now, and it is.
But that was 2017, the first year of the first Trump administration.
Correct. And I think that I had mainly I felt at that point like I had given everything that I could to my profession, and that for me it was beginning to be diminishing returns. I was taking it to heart. Probably way too much because my personality is that I'm not very good at compartmentalization. And so when I would hear criticisms of the press, you know, obviously some justified, but the type that's just dismissive altogether, like, oh, it's just fake news.
Fake news, yeah.
Enemies of the people.
Never heard of that before 2016. Huh?
Right. It really got to me. And I wouldn't say that I was full-on depressed, but I was to the point where I felt a little bit like, you know, I want to stop while I'm ahead. I want to not be the crabby old lady in the corner shaking her finger at the young upstart journalists who, you know, some of them were excellent people. And others, I felt, you know, probably could have used a little bit of that old school, you know, actually go out and sit with your source and look them in the eye and get to know who they are.
They could have used a Michael in their lives.
They could have used a Michael. They could have used a Michael Kelly from the Lake Oswego Review or a Kevin Harden from the Beaverton Valley Times or a Christina Lent, all the people that I worked with. A Janie Nafsinger, whose dad, Dick Nafsinger, was the Hood River News. And I realized, too, that being a baby boomer, but a youngish baby boomer, you know, I tried to take the attitude of there's nothing new under the sun, but this felt new. This felt like the profession that I and many others had given their lifeblood to. And you don't go into journalism, newspaper journalism, to get rich. It really rarely happens. You go because you feel like it's a service to the community that you work in. But when it began to shift in ways that I thought were that just didn't comport with what I had been taught about truth finding and the importance of facts and, you know, the accusations of, like I just mentioned, the enemies of the people. It just started to feel like it was time for me to go and hopefully have other younger journalists take up the torch and find a new way forward.
And we'll talk about this later. It probably hasn't improved a whole lot in the last 8 years.
It doesn't seem so.
No, not at all.
It's discouraging.
Now, when you retired, you were approaching 60 at that point and out of the newspaper business, ready to enjoy retirement.
Yeah, I didn't know what that meant or would mean.
But after 38 years of covering late-breaking stories and writing on deadline, illegal gambling operations, it's become kind of a meme. You're not exactly going to sit back and play golf all day. Is that when you started writing Sunshine Girl?
Not right away. I had a party for myself at our floating home. I said, you know, I'm going to invite all my former colleagues to come to our house and just sort of celebrate together. Many of my journalism friends had already retired. Some had actually made the jump from journalism to public relations. And so we just gathered, and I didn't know what was going to happen after that. I knew I wanted to take a little bit of a rest, a little bit of a break. I think my husband and I probably took a trip to Kauai. We really love the island of Kauai. And then when I got home, I thought, okay, I still have a lot of life to live, and I want to be generative and not stagnant. I had heard that that's the choice in your third act, and I believe that I was starting my third act at age 60 by then, that I wanted to do something that was a new challenge. I knew what it meant to persevere, not just from journalism, but I had also been a regular marathon runner for a number of years and did a lot of training. You have to stay really focused on the goal. And I thought, all right, I've done that. What can I do now? And I thought, what if I tried to write fiction? Which was a very sort of a foreign concept to me. Of course, I'd read novels.
You hadn't written any stories before, any fiction in the past?
Creative nonfiction, I would say, but...
But you didn't sit down to write like a short story or start a book?
Not a fiction piece. Uh-huh. It was, I mean, in my career, it was, of course, all just factual, fact-based
news.
Wow,
so that's a really big challenge.
Yeah. Well, I was familiar with my friend Laura Stanfill, and right. I know you know Laura, and you know, she had made the transition from journalism to becoming
a published author herself.
Yeah, and running her own small press in Portland, Forest Avenue Press. And, you know, I admire Laura greatly, and I thought, you know, maybe I can give this a shot. And at that point, I had joined the Pinewood Table for a short time that is no more, but it was a very revered writing group in Portland.
Joanna Rose and Stephen Allred.
Correct. Yeah. Wonderful teachers. And I didn't start Sunshine Girl in that group, but I was writing. I was trying my hand at, you know, shorter fictionalized pieces and workshopped them with that group for a short period of time. And then I found another writing group that happened to be all women.
Was that the one in the basement of a friend?
Yeah, exactly. It was in a friend's basement, Susie Vitello. She started a very small all-women writing group. I don't know that it set out to be all women, but it just turned out it was.
And Susie's, she was in the famous Tom Spanbauer Dangerous Writers writing group, too.
Right. I knew Susie to be... kind of reminded me of Letty Owings, to be frank, you know, tough but fair and very encouraging, which is what I needed. I needed somebody, I had been critiqued and edited my whole career. That wasn't a problem for me, but I did need somebody that could take me by the hand and, you know, come alongside when I struggled. You know, where do I go from here with this story? I've got this vision, but I don't know how to make it happen exactly. I'm going to start with some words, sentences, paragraphs, and pages, but where do I go? And so that group was really helpful. Their wisdom was immense. Their heart was big collectively. And I started out writing this story in that writing group. I started off with a rally in downtown Portland to support journalists. That's the prologue in the book.
Did you start that like in 2018 then?
I think
about
it was
a year
still,
after you retired?
Or? Yeah, within a year, probably early 2018.
And I read that you finished the first draft in 2021, so it took a few years. How'd you go about revising it at that point and getting it ready for publication? Here it is 4 years later.
Yeah. A much longer process than I was used to, Ken. I mean, in journalism, again, it's, you know, you interview for a story and you bang it out and
it's published the next day.
It's done. And then you're moving on. Maybe you're writing 5 to 8 stories a week and, you know, they're not long form. They're generally 10 or maybe 20 column inches. And so you learn concise. You learn
the 5 W's and all.
Yeah. And you learn, you know, the pyramid method where the most important information has to be up top because it's very likely your story is literally going to be cut from the bottom. And so the very last sentences have to be, you know, able to go. and so...
It's not like a surprise plot twist at the very last paragraph.
No, no, you don't want to have your cliffhanger at the end. And so beginning this novel was a completely different way of writing. And what I found was that it allowed me to kind of set my mind and heart free in a way that I hadn't. Very much in journalism. I did really enjoy writing features for the newspapers, and I wrote a lot of profiles, and that was a little bit more loosey-goosey in terms of as over against hard news, but never in this long form. You know, I knew that I was going to have to come up with somewhere between 60 and 80,000 words, you know, which is a sort of a legit length novel. And I just kept at it, adding little bits to little bits. And, you know, I would run them by my writing group people, and they'd say, yeah, this works, but I don't like that part. And we would talk it out. It's like being in a relationship, you know. You'd figure out what rose to the top, and you'd let go of the stuff that wasn't working. And if they were confused, you knew you had to revise. And I did have several developmental edits, which is a pretty overarching, you know, 10,000-foot view done on the novel as I went along, and then a couple of more micro-level edits done, which is different than line edit, which is different than proofreading. It's all these layers.
you learned all this.
Yeah, I did.
While writing the novel.
I knew some of it. Uh-huh. I knew some of it, but I did not. What I did not know, Ken, is that it would take that long. Because I was so used to just, you know, one and done and moving on. But it was a really, really good and thorough education. And I know I have still a ton to learn.
Now, Heliotrope Books, the publisher, and Naomi Rosenblatt at Heliotrope accepted the book. And then it was another year and a half of revisions. And now here we are 8 years later, total, after starting on Sunshine Girl. In a recent Substack post, Nancy, you describe it as a love letter to my former profession, but also, quote, 8 years of my life to tell about 40, to give my testimony about what happened to newspapers between Nixon and Biden. Trump's not in here.
before, not by name.
right. Before and since the rise of the internet, to hint at what befell them in the time of alternative facts, the time of working up to devastation. So it's both a love letter and somewhat of a eulogy.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that. I, you're right. I like to think of it in my heart of hearts as a love letter, but I also know that it's a bit of a clanging bell, a little bit of a, you know, what is happening and how do we fix this?
A call to arms, even.
A call
Maybe
to
more
arms.
So than a eulogy.
I had an event last night at which I spoke about how the First Amendment seems to be under attack on all sides, you know, from, you know, the freedom to peaceably assemble to freedom of speech to freedom of the press. And I do feel like it's an all hands on deck emergency in our country. I do believe that even though the Washington Post has changed its tack recently, that the masthead that the Washington Post adopted during the first Trump administration really is true, which is democracy dies in darkness. Darkness for me is when people are either reading outright propaganda or listening to outright propaganda, watching outright propaganda. I don't believe we are in a strict sense there quite yet, but I do think that many, many people are being deceived and gaslit by news outlets and, you know, that call themselves news that really are not fact-based. And so it's a critical time. And I have talked about that in public, and it's in the book as well, though I think the book at its core is, I hope, a lamp, not to get biblical, but a lamp to the feet of future journalists. And I am hoping that even though over the last 10 years, something like 750 journalists have been killed worldwide, that we can, as a culture, embrace the idea that the Fourth Estate is one of the pillars of our nation if we want to remain a free people.
And freedom of the press is part of that First Amendment, so
yes, exactly.
Even the founders knew that.
Yes.
Now, the story in the book is told through a multi-generational cast of characters, all journalists, and it tracks the trajectory of your career in journalism from a decade or so before your first newspaper job. So the book starts in 1968, and the book's present day is 2022. And you've said the initial idea, again, a quote, turned into a family saga, complete with divorce, disease, secret subterfuge, and leprechauns, the main
yes.
characters of Irish origin. Was that a pleasant surprise, like when fiction writers talk about how their characters just kind of talk to them and take over? Say, no, I don't want to do that. I want to do this.
Yeah, it was a pleasant surprise for sure. And though I don't know that I believe strictly in that thought, like for me, I don't know that my characters literally talked to me, but I kept, and I always have done this, I kept a pad of paper and a pen at my bedside. And when I inevitably would wake in the night and an idea came to me, or maybe in a dream or something, even if I thought it was nonsensical, I would write it down. And some of the twists and turns in the novel were from those moments. I didn't know that, I kind of call it a wild ride. I sort of taste tested this with a number of beta readers to make sure that I wasn't sort of spinning out, you know, because I wanted it to make sense. It needed to be a story about journalists who deeply cared about what they were doing and about the people they were representing in the news. And I think I kept to that. But along the way, the human foibles are front and center. And I think it makes for a very human story, at least I hope so. My character, Martin, who people have asked me who was my favorite one to write, and I have to pick Martin because he's probably the character that changes the most throughout the narrative. And he does it by coming to terms with his own examined life. He's not afraid to say, yeah, I really blew it there, and I want to try to make amends with, you know, for people that I've hurt, which I've found in my own life is an important aspect of, you know, being as wholly human as I can be, and to an understanding other people, and hoping to become more understanding and empathetic toward others. And that's what happens with Martin in the book. His daughter Eliza is a firebrand, and she's like everything that I was not when I was a young journalist, because remember, this was back in the era where, you know, it was not unusual to have a male coworker flirt with you and not to know what to do. And, you know, many of us had that experience.
Yeah, more sexist environment.
A little bit more. Yeah, yeah.
Not that sexism has disappeared.
No, and I don't, you know, I think it cuts both ways, of course, too. But and Eliza, I think she gains from her dad's workplace. She learns about journalism through osmosis, through spending time in the newsroom with her dad and listening to him interview sources on the phone, watching him rush out of the office to, you know, meet with someone who was in crisis and, you know, needed to talk to a journalist about what was going on, whether that was they just lost their lease for unknown reasons or whatever it might be. But Eliza really takes on the mantle early. And indeed, her grandfather in the book was also a newsman. Ink in the blood.
Colin Donovan. And he was a popular columnist at the Oregon Journal in
That's
the book.
Right. That's right.
Oregon Journal, of course, really exists. It doesn't anymore. But
that's exactly
it's a real
right.
newspaper and very popular in Portland.
Yes. Yes. You mentioned the leprechauns, and not to give too much away, but there was an editor at the Oregon Journal who had a column called, I believe it was called Mill Ends, maybe. And it featured leprechauns. And so I thought, wouldn't that be a fun thing to put in the book? Because Martin Donovan in the book is Irish.
Now, a little bit more about Eliza. I know you've said she's the embodiment of what I'm quoting now. Looking back, I would have wanted for my career, had I known back then what I knew by 2017, agency, forthrightness, confidence, sticking up for what I knew was right. Eliza is fiery and bold and determined, ready to take on a changing new news landscape. She is me at my best, most genuine grown-up self. And it's interesting that you have Eliza as more of your ideal, what you aspire to or would have aspired to in hindsight. And Martin is maybe more the real you, both in love with journalism, telling the truth in your reporting, but also willing to compromise as needed to maintain your career, kind of going along to get along.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So you had the ideal Nancy and kind of the more real Nancy during that 38-year period.
Yeah, almost like the alter ego. I mean, I think one thing that I've learned in living as long as I have now and being in the news environment and swimming in that soup is that, you know, there's no such thing as perfection. You're not always going to be listened to, but you can keep bringing up your ideas and hoping that they catch fire. And Eliza was just, you know, she was determined from the very beginning to have her voice heard, which I think is something to aspire to. But when it comes right down to it, maybe the more important quality is just being true to yourself and true to the people around you in terms of, you know, trying to get your message across, whether somebody adopts it or not.
You know, something I wanted to ask you, too, because I noticed it in the book when you mentioned Eliza's kind of the focus and her own voice in the book. She's the only one that has first-person narration.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the chapters, and there's 72 chapters in the book, are third-person. Eliza's, or some of Eliza's that she appears in, are narrated by her in the first person, including the very beginning, the prologue, and then the very end, the epilogue. So we're sandwiched by Eliza's voice. Why did you mix in these first-person accounts and the more objective third-person narration to kind of prioritize Eliza's point of view so we would see a lot of the story through her eyes?
I wanted the Eliza character to show some agency and some urgency because I felt that that was really innate to who she is as a character. I wasn't sure that that format or that approach would work in the narrative arc, but I do believe that it does. I think having her start off in first person and then continue along, she grows up in the book. She starts off, other than the prologue, she starts off as a child.
As a little girl, yeah.
Yes. Well, in she's fact, even we, born in the book.
Yeah, we see her birth there to Martin and Judith.
Yeah. I felt like it stayed true to just her boldness, her verve, I guess. I liked first person because it felt so present. It felt so in the moment. And that's very much a part of Eliza's personality. She's not one to suffer fools gladly. She's not one to perseverate about what she said to someone and how that was taken. And, ooh, maybe they thought I meant that. That is not Eliza at all. And so I felt like keeping her voice in first person carried that throughout the book thematically, where all the other characters could be in third, although I think most of them, more the major characters, that would be Mina, Martin, Judith to some extent, are a close third.
Third person close. Yeah. So we're inside their head, but still it's narrated in third person.
Right, right. They're not, you know, some ethereal voice coming through. They're real people. but Eliza was always the one that just kind of needed to be a little bit in your face, but not in a annoying way, kind of just in a, this is who I am kind of way. No apologies. Yeah.
So we have Martin and his daughter, Eliza. Mm-hmm. There's also another main character in the book, Mina Breckenridge.
Correct.
Not part of Martin and Eliza's family directly, but their journalism colleague, both of them. And Martin helps Mina get her first job as a sports reporter, like you, mm-hmm. on a community newspaper, The Cascadian, just as Michael Fagan got you your first job or persuaded the publisher. And Mina then serves as Eliza's mentor, helping her get her first job on a paper in Juneau, Alaska. I'm guessing there's a little of you and Mina as well.
Yeah, you know, darn it, there is. Yeah, I like to
think.
Well,
a lot of writers do that, where they have you know, some composites, some of them in in at least, not just one character, maybe two, three, or four.
Right, yes, and you're You're absolutely right. Mina is an amalgam, and I'm in there for sure. Because in my career, I was fortunate to be able to mentor quite a few younger journalists. And I would say that period of time was in like the late 90s to the mid 2000s. That was the main time when I wasn't managing editor. I was still an editor and a reporter. But the new journalists coming in, you know, they needed guidance like I was fortunate to have. And that was a really fun part of my job. And so...
And Mina has that too. She's both mentee when she starts out and then becomes mentor as she becomes an experienced journalist.
Exactly right. In some ways, you can almost do that concurrently. But in Mina's case, she starts out with covering sports, which was foreign to her, just like it was foreign to me. But she soon finds herself, as is wont to happen at small newspapers, covering everything from school board to parks board to city council to feature stories to breaking news, any of it. You just have to really be flexible. And then as she kind of gets her sea legs under her, Eliza's getting a little bit older. She's maybe, I don't know, 8-10 years old. And then Mina is the one that sort of takes Eliza under her wing. She doesn't have children of her own. She's unmarried. Martin's very, very busy at this point. He's wearing a bunch of hats as news editor. And so Mina takes Eliza out on her first assignment. And Eliza has already, you know, been bitten by the reporting bug. But it just encourages her along. And they part ways for a goodly number of years.
And then meet up again in Juneau,
Meet up again
Alaska.
In Juneau, yeah.
Now, the novel is structured in three sections. Heyday, which takes us from 1968 to 1988. Payday, 1988 to 2005. And Mayday, 2006 to the end of the story in 2022. Now, in those three section titles, along with the dates, you get a good idea of where journalism started in the late 60s and progressed, if that's the right word.
Right. Evolved, devolved,
yeah,
I don't know.
Devolved. Changed, not necessarily all for the better, to close to our present day. Can you explain why you gave these names to those periods? So Heyday, Payday, and finally Mayday.
Right. It just occurred to me early on, and I know that I had some help with this concept from Susie. I want to credit her. I don't know if I came up with the names or she did. I don't even remember. But it seemed like since this was such a long period of time, I mean, some novels occur over a 24-hour period, right? Some, and this one was over, essentially.
Ulysses, James Joyce.
Yeah.
One day in Dublin.
I didn't know that I set out to do that, but I did know that I was first impressed as a young teenager by the journalists that I would read, you know, The Washington Post, Watergate, you know, how Woodward and Bernstein covered that scandal and, you know, essentially changed the trajectory of a presidency. And so I knew that that felt to me. And again, I don't know that I have the years strictly correct with the three sections, but in general, those first years were the heyday for newspapers. I mean, I remember my parents, you know, subscribing, and, you know, the dailies were not only dailies, but there were morning and evening editions. That's how important and part of the fabric of the culture physical newspapers were. Practically everyone subscribed to the local newspaper and probably took the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or, you know, the Big City Daily. If you lived in a suburb of L.A., you probably took the Orange County Register, but you also took the L.A. Times, right? Yeah. And when it started to shift, I mean, I am not a scholar on the history of newspaper journalism, but anecdotally, I would definitely say the Ronald Reagan years, when the Fairness Doctrine was done away with, that really, I think, was kind of the kernel, the beginnings of the bifurcation of news, in the sense that the news ecosystem wasn't being as closely monitored for whether it was delivering, you know,
balanced
news. And then the idea of you had to report a story equally on both sides started to kind of gain traction. And I remember even as a By then, I was probably in my early 40s, thinking to myself, but every news story can't be reported on both sides evenly, because depending on what the issue is that the reporter is covering, they aren't equal weight, you know? I should have probably come up with a good example, but it was more important to just make sure that there were multiple voices in the story, to make sure that you were, as a reporter, doing your due diligence and not, you know, not just doing what we used to call a one and done, you know.
Multiple voices and multiple sources too.
Yeah.
Some editors demand two or three sources minimum.
Right. And I think that used to be the standard. That was de rigueur. We did not turn in a story if we had only one voice or even two. We had sometimes four or five, depending on what we were writing about. So doing away with the fairness doctrine, I feel like sort of initiated a bit of a more lackadaisical attitude toward performance and standards. Not to say that there weren't still dedicated, diligent, you know, ambitious journalists out there, because there certainly were and are, thank goodness. But that was the beginning of, well, we were still in the payday days. And what I meant by that was not that journalists made a lot of money, but that they were financially, the news organs were financially sustainable. And, you know, doing quite well. I mean, when I was in Lake Oswego, it was a fairly small community, but we had a newsroom of, I would say, 12 to 15 people. That was, at the time, I thought, oh, this is normal. And it was. But then, that isn't the case these days. There are some communities that are either don't have a newspaper at all. They're being referred to as news deserts, which I think does a real disservice to the people living in that community, because it's very important, I think, for them to see an objective source that reflects back to them what is happening in their community. I think, too, if you don't have reporters covering public agencies and sort of holding the people that run them accountable, you know, digging into public records regarding the way money is spent, taxpayer money, you know, a lot can happen behind the scenes that isn't exactly kosher, you know,
right.
And people maybe don't even know about it. One of the reasons I named the book, titled the book Sunshine Girl, you know, there's one reason that becomes clear as you read the story, but another...
It's Eliza's nickname. Martin gives her that nickname.
Exactly. She's his sunshine girl. But the other reason is because of the sunshine laws that we still have on the books in our nation, where Joe or Jane citizen are supposed to be able to go down to their municipality and request public records. And they should not have to wait for months and months or years and years to be provided those records. They're called sunshine laws. And, you know, you can imagine the metaphor is that it shines a light on
right.
what's happening in public agencies that are funded by people, the people of our nation. Not the wealthy people, but all the people.
All the people of the nation, not just the billionaires.
Right. So it's one way to keep the playing field at least somewhat level. The other thing that happened in the mid-90s, of course, you know, the internet, the information superhighway.
Yeah, and everything.
It changed everything. And we were all agog and, you know, it's like, what is this thing? This is amazing. Look, we have all this information at our fingertips.
I think most people were very optimistic and look what it turned into, kind of almost a sewer.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Not the internet itself, but social media.
Yeah, there's been... I mean, I feel like it's a definite double-edged sword. There's so much good about technology. There's so much good about being able to Google something and, you know, figure out, you know, what does that mean? I do that all the time. But there's a dark side to it. And one of the dark sides for the newspapers, and I don't know if all my former colleagues would agree with this, but I remember vividly sitting in a meeting in the late 90s, maybe early 2000s, and our managers were talking about how they wanted us reporters to file and post our stories online on our websites, not always on, I don't think social media was a big thing then. No, it wasn't. But they wanted us to publish it online ahead of the print product. In other words, people could read our stories by a click of the mouse and not wait for their, you know, newspaper to come in the mail or be delivered or whatever. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm no economic genius, but that seems like we're shooting ourselves in the foot. Why are we giving away our stories for free? They tried to monetize, you know, that aspect, the websites, and I, you know, to some degree of success. But I really do believe it became a slippery slope financially because people dropped their subscriptions, which had been the bread and butter for decades.
And when subscriptions drop, ads drop because you're not reaching the same number of people anymore, and you're going to advertise on the internet.
Exactly. And display ads, which were the big, you know, oh, let's say you were a furniture store, you might have taken out a full page ad about the you know, Memorial Day sale you were having on mattresses or something. And I don't even know how much that would have cost. But if there's no print product that people are reading, that's not how you want to spend your advertising budget. You might buy a smaller ad online. And so I think at least the newspapers I worked for really wrestled with how to manage these new circumstances and turn them to their advantage. That was a business after all. I think another thing it did, because I've heard this a lot, is that people that I knew started saying, well, you know, Why would I buy a subscription? I mean, why would I pay for the news?
I mean, right, I can get that online.
Exactly. Yeah. Why would I do that? And I remember feeling like, well, wait a minute, you can't walk into a grocery store and buy mangoes for, you know, 2 cents, that they cost what they cost, you know. But the people, they were so used to getting it then online for free. And that's when paywalls started. Some newspapers started paywalls. The company that I worked for kind of, they didn't want to do that. And they held off for a long time doing that.
But and you mentioned something in the book called advertorials.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an early concept, actually.
Okay.
Special section.
Somebody will actually pay for a feature article that promotes their product.
Yes. And even back in the 80s, we did advertorial sections that were special sections that were inserted into the print paper, but they were topical. So like we would do one on all the real estate companies and what kinds of homes they were building. And it was written in news style, but it was definitely skewed toward making that company look good. You know, and so it was a bit like infotainment is now, sort of a hybrid of information and entertainment. This was a hybrid of news reporting and advertising, which used to be paid. So
now truth and truth telling is a big theme in the book and in journalism, which shows the consequences. The book shows the consequences of withholding the truth, keeping secrets, which can lead to disaster,
yes.
Disastrous consequences, as well as the dangers of telling the truth, which can also have very negative results. Now, novelists often talk about the power of fiction to get at the truth. In other words, making things up to kind of portray the truth. How does that compare with the quest for truth as a journalist, where, of course, you can't make anything up? You're not supposed to, unless you're Fox News, I guess.
Yeah, unfortunately. So yes, truth in fiction. Somebody asked me this question the other day about why did I think fiction was a good vehicle for truth telling? And I think it's because in a novel, in a essentially made up story, which of course even all fiction is derived from life. You don't, you know, everybody's experience as an author shows up in their work, whether it's nonfiction, creative nonfiction, memoir, or fiction. But I think a novel like this gives the reader multiple entry points in terms of its relatability.
Through the characters, generally.
Through the characters, the more the writer can imbue their characters with human traits, foibles, mistakes, redemption, you know, relational gaffes, professional gaffes. any of it, and they can sort of live to tell the story, so to speak, you know, I think that is where you can really highlight how, in the end, truth, as they say, will out. Yeah. And I think one of the big themes in this novel, and what I really wanted to underscore, and I hope that I did a good job, is that we pay a price as a society when we put our heads in the sand and maybe, you know, you've heard the phrase or the term, willful ignorance. If you just don't want to know, if you would rather, if you choose to say, well, I don't want to believe that's happening, and so I'm just going to consume the media that comports with my worldview.
Ah, he has a Grateful Dead song, to paraphrase, you're not going to learn what you don't want to know.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I guess defines willful ignorance.
Yeah, of course, people have free will. They can choose what they choose. But I do think that the subtle and now not so subtle chinking away or banging away at truth in our societal circles is really turning us against each other. You know, the old "a house divided cannot long stand," divided against itself cannot stand. That's you know, maybe we're not 100% there, but that's one of the things that disagreements or fights over whether facts are facts or whether they're alternative facts
yeah.
has done. I think it has caused an uprising where people who prefer to believe the story that's in their heads instead of the ones they know deep down is real. It's the whole Orwell 1984 thing, you know, the thought police, you know. I didn't want to believe that. But now I see that it's starting to come full circle.
I have a friend from junior high school.
Right.
Who I still see, who's certainly in that situation.
Yeah.
Can't talk to them.
Yeah.
They have their own set of facts, alternative facts, not
yeah.
real ones.
And I had an interesting conversation with someone maybe, I don't know, a couple of years ago, probably during the pandemic when we were all sort of isolated in our little home pods. And this person was talking about fact versus opinion. And it was almost as if the two words had become
one?
The same thing.
Oh, because I always heard you're entitled to your own opinions, but not your own facts.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That line's been blurred.
The line has been blurred. I think there are some folks who really think that they may not define it that way, but they may espouse a point of view. And if, you know, the person that they're in conversation with says, well, wait a minute, that sounds like opinion, but they're like, well, that's, you know, you have your opinion and I have my opinion. And so I think it makes the debate a little harder to have in a genuine and fortuitous or helpful way.
Certainly yeah. in a society where you depend on, for debate on rational thought.
Yeah, yeah.
Where that's out the window.
Is rational thought?
Yeah. Now, you've said, and I quote, I hope readers take away the idea that newspaper journalism is an honorable career and a worthy career. Do you still feel that way about the profession here and now in 2025?
I absolutely do. I know in my heart that there are people out there doing this hard work every single day that are carrying forward the torch. I do believe it's an honorable profession. I don't see journalists kowtowing. I think it's a scary time because, as I mentioned before, there are literally journalists who have been abducted and murdered for speaking truth or writing truth around the world and in our own country.
But there are journalists, maybe you wouldn't use the word journalist for them, who very willingly will tell lies for their network.
Including
them as folks. Journalists. Okay.
No, I, it's very sad to me that someone would hang a shingle out there and call themselves a journalist that just you know, the press secretary currently just, I mean,
oh my gosh.
Absolutely yes. Lies every single day and hangs it on, you know, this is the truth. And it's gaslighting. I address gaslighting in the book. I know it's a concept that some folks have trouble with, but I think there is a manipulation afoot in some sectors of the media. But I also think that there are Antelnes of the world who would quit their
position. She left
position.
The Washington Post.
She left
right.
the Washington Post because, you know, did not feel like the management and the direction the paper was going for her was going to work anymore.
Well, I think Jeff Bezos prevented her from actually printing an editorial, right?
Cartoon. Yeah. I think that was the case. Yeah. And I think for me, you know, one of my moments of truth was when we were asked, and it felt very much like a directive and not a request, that we should go ahead and as soon as we had a story done, we should post it online even before we fact checked it. And to me, that was a tantamount to abdication. I thought, how can we do journalism without fact checking? I mean, okay, it's cool. Then you fact check in the next couple of hours and you go back in to your story online and you fix it. But by then, how many people have read it?
Right. And also spread it and shared it. That's how social media works now.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I used the term loosey-goosey a little bit ago. And I think that was part of what has led to where we're at now, where we just kind of step back and didn't do that one last step, didn't make that one last phone call. You know, Mina in the novel, she's the person of one more phone call, one more interview. I've got to get this right. And I will go to my grave thinking that journalism is an honorable profession. And though it deeply saddens and distresses me that, you know, it is sort of in some circles been reduced to one rung lower than, I mean, I don't know what you might say, a used car salesman. No offense to used car salesman, but...
But a pretty good analogy.
Yeah.
It's when seeking of truth becomes the seeking of... desire for hits, popularity, how many people are going to read my little post here, my story.
Right.
And then celebrity. Yeah. A lot of the so-called broadcast journalists now become celebrities. Even somebody like Anderson Cooper on CNN, you know, he shows up drunk on New Year's Eve. Mm. Walter Cronkite would have never done that. Mm. And that goes with the way I want to, last thing I want to ask you about. I know you're heading to New York tomorrow for your first trip to the city.
I am.
You have an event at Brooklyn's Unnameable Bookstore. That's next Friday.
That's right, the 9th.
And you'll also be meeting your publisher at Heliotrope, Naomi Rosenblatt, for the first time in person. I noticed, I get the Sunday New York Times, the print edition. Which I consider like literature. It takes me a whole week to read.
Yeah.
And a lot of the stories never go out of date. It's just beautiful feature writing, literary feature writing in a way. I noticed there was a big ad in the leisure section for a new Broadway show called Good Night and Good Luck.
Oh, awesome.
Starring George Clooney, who starred in the original movie in 2005, based on Edward R. Murrow.
Yes.
One of the great journalists and broadcasters and an exemplar, I think, of what journalism could and should be. I was just wondering if you're getting tickets for that as kind of a look back. You know, I mentioned Walter Cronkite, Edward R. Murrow was his predecessor.
Right.
And then there's Dan Rather, maybe the last of the great journalists. Mm-hmm. I don't know who would be that like that. Even Rachel Maddow now, I think, might not be objective enough to be in that class, even though I think she does try to stick to the facts as much as possible, with a slant to it, obviously. I guess my question is, are you going to go see that and kind of get that in your mind again and what journalism used to be and what it could be?
Oh, wow. I love that. And I'm so glad you mentioned it because my college friend, Leslie, who is very New York savvy, she has a daughter who lives there and some grandkids. She mentioned that to me and I had totally forgotten about it. So as soon as I get home, Ken, I'm going to look that up and see if I can get tickets. My family, my two daughters and their kids are also going to join us in New York. And so it's going to be a very busy time. I don't know exactly all of the things that we're going to get to do, but I would love that. Good night and good luck. I mean, what a sign off, you know? It almost makes me emotional to think about that because, you know, and maybe it's a generational thing. You know, maybe now I'm at the age where I'm looking back and thinking, oh, those were the days. But in many ways, they were. And I would add one more, person to the list.
Luminary to the pantheon.
Yeah, luminary. Yeah, Katharine Graham.
Washington Post.
Yeah, I just think that this was a woman who took on the mantle at the Washington Post after her husband died. And, you know, it was a time when women didn't do that. You know, but Katharine stepped into the breach, and she did so much. She advanced the cause of, you know, the free press through the Washington Post. She was managing, of course, the whole thing, including
the Woodward Bernstein.
Yeah, era. Yeah, and it was really her kind of, you know, going to the mat for those two reporters, and making sure that their FOIA requests went through, and, you know, leaning on the political operatives to do the right thing and release the records and the White House, and I mean, you know. She took on the establishment, and, you know, are there still people like that? I think so. I think the independent journalists at The Contrarian are doing an awesome job. You know, Ruth Marcus and
Jen Rubin,
and I mean, there are people out there, and we're now those of us who really do care about truth and are determined not to allow ourselves to be gaslit by the current administration or any of the people at, Fox News or, I don't know, where we want Voice of America back. We want NPR and PBS to be robust. We want, you know, programs like yours to be able to continue. And we're kind of the Katharine Grahams of our era. Where I feel like that. I know it's a little bit of a crazy comparison, but you get to the end of your life. I know for myself, I want to be able to stand up and say, you know, I did my best. I did what I thought was right. Sometimes I made mistakes, but overall, I really tried to not be there because of my ego or myself, but for the people. And that's what our nation was founded on. We the people, not them the rulers. And I really do sincerely believe that journalism has a role there to play. And it's a serious one. And I hope the pendulum begins to swing back a bit.
Well, Nancy, thanks so much for talking with us today. Hope you have a great trip to New York, my hometown.
Yay.
So when you get back, you got to let me know if the bagels are any good.
I definitely will. We're gonna get some New York bagels and some pizza. And, you know, we've got some good suggestions for people in that area. I don't know where I'm going to have lunch with my publisher, but I'm sure that since she's a lifelong New Yorker, she'll have a good suggestion.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again. You can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Nancy Townsley, author of the new novel Sunshine Girl from Heliotrope Books. If you're in the New York area, Nancy will be reading and signing books at Unnameable Books in Brooklyn, Unpronounceable Books, I think, for me, tomorrow, Friday, May 9th at 7 p.m. And she'll be back in Portland on Sunday, June 15th at Rose City Book Pub in conversation with Renee Denfeld. You can learn more about Nancy, the new book, and all her events online at nancytownsley.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, May 22nd. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
democracies die in darkness.